You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And if you're listening to us live, this is Friday, March 23rd, 2012. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast at 8 a.m. on Monday morning, welcome to a new week. This is Writers' Voices, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And I don't have my usual co-host and wonderful mom with me today, Caroline Kilbourne. She had a tooth pulled this week and is taking a little break, but she'll be back with us next week. However, I do have actually two very intriguing guests today, both connected with the Mission Creek Literary Festival that is happening in Iowa City next week as part of the Mission Creek Festival. And we had a guest last week who is also participating in that, Luis Alberto Orea, which if you missed that interview, please check it out on writersvoices.com or krufm.com, because it was really one of, in all the years I've been doing this, one of the most enjoyable interviews that I've ever done. Our guest today is Ray Bryant. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Ray.
Hi, Monica. Thank you for having me.
Great. Now, Ray Bryant is part of the Emerging Writers contingent at the festival, although from her resume, I could say she's been emerging for quite a while now. Ray Bryant's short story collection, The Indefinite State of Imaginary Morals, was released from Patasola Press, New York, in June 2011. It has been nominated for the 2012 Penn Hemingway and Pushcart Awards. Wow. Her stories have appeared in Story Quarterly, McSweeney's, and many, many more. She writes essays and reviews as well for such places as Puerta del Sol, The Nervous Breakdown, Portland Book Review, and she has received fellowships including from the Johns Hopkins University, where she earned a master's in writing and attended the Conference on Craft in Florence, Italy, studying with and assisting Jill McCorkle. She also attended the Sewanee Writers Conference, where she studied with National Book Award winner Alice McDermott. She teaches multimedia and creative writing in the Johns Hopkins University Graduate Writing Program and is the editor-in-chief of their new literary and arts journal, the Dr. T.J. Eckelberg Review. Wow, that's quite a resume you've got.
Well, thank you. It's been a very busy year.
I bet. So, let's start at the beginning and your path to becoming a creative fiction and nonfiction writer. Where did you start?
I taught English at the secondary level, high school level, for a number of years, English and gifted and talented students, and I taught with a degree in humanities. My undergrad was in humanities, which basically was a study of literature, art, philosophy, sculpture, history, anthropology, you know, kind of a master of surfaces of many things, and not a whole lot of depth with anything, but it gives you a good taste for it. And so I was really a study of it. I wrote sort of in the closet for a while. I really enjoyed sharing the love of literature and art with students. And then it was maybe about 8 years ago, I sat down with my own project, and I really, at that time, came out of the closet, so to speak. I had started frequenting a few smaller writers' conferences and just getting my feet wet, basically, as an actual writer. So I guess it was about 8 years ago that I actually started writing out of the closet, but it was probably about 2 years ago, well, maybe 2-3 years ago, that I went into program at Hopkins, and it felt like I was actually starting to form voice and so on. And then in the last year or so is whenever things started to move, I guess.
Wow. So do you identify yourself now as a writer?
Oh, absolutely. Seeing works in print as an author is certainly wonderful. The most wonderful parts of that for me are is the chance to interact with readers. I believe in reader response theory, and I think that readers bring to every story their own story, and so your own story becomes very different for each reader who engages with it. I also enjoy reading, reading my work aloud in reading series and so on, so that part of it's very important to me. But the craft itself, sitting down with story and exploring characters and setting and maybe even a particular era of the world or life that intrigues me, that is writing. That's not being an author. That is the craft itself, and that is certainly what drew me to it first and foremost and still draws me to it.
Wow. So when you were a high school teacher, were you always dreaming of someday being a writer?
Honestly, I can't say that I was. I was very happy to study and read. I was primarily a reader. I spent a lot of time with classics. I spent a lot of time with the modernists. The turn of century, of course, being the turn of the 18th and then the 19th century, was really important to me. Even before that, Wollstonecraft and Shelley, and then into Wharton and Chopin. And then I did, of course, I enjoyed Hemingway and Steinbeck and Bach and, a number of writers. So I really enjoyed teaching these, and Fitzgerald, of course. I enjoy teaching these to secondary students to see them engage with them. So that was really enough for me for quite a while. Whenever I decided that I was going to write out of the closet is whenever I decided to actually go at that full force and go back to school for a master's and really dig into it as a full-time endeavor, I guess. And so I don't really feel like I ever spent time wishing to do something I wasn't doing. Being a teacher for me was enough. Time.
Well, it sounds like once you made the decision to make this career change that things really came together for you.
I've been very fortunate. I've had some excellent mentors along the way. I've had opportunity to explore voice and get out and meet people, and I've spent a good deal of time just enjoying journals, short story journals, poetry journals, out and about. And I've been fortunate that some of those journals and editors have similarly enjoyed my work, too. Yes, I guess I have been.
When I look through the table of contents from your book that came out last summer, The Indefinite State of Imaginary Morals, it looks like most of the stories in there had been published in various literary journals previously. And, maybe you can tell us, we can talk a little bit about the place that literary journals play in kind of the literary world today.
Yeah, it's such a good question, and I'm so glad you asked it. I do wholeheartedly believe in the place of literary journals in publishing. Many literary journals are what we might call small press. Some of them we would call university press. They may not be the journals of the central New York publishing land, so to speak. But what they do in their own right is really, I feel, focused on the voice and the story, and they allow for a certain amount of experimentation in story and voice. I have found, at least in my experience thus far, which is really not much comparatively, certainly, but in my experience, I found that journals are where the new voices are generally coming out. The journals often have a dedication towards finding those newer voices, whereas the more established big publishing houses, they do such good work. And I also find that they're working with voices that often are already established and have kind of some cases, maybe even in many cases, have come up through the journals, the small presses and the university presses, so to speak, the independent presses, I guess you'll call them. I think it's really interesting, and I think it's really important to remember that these journals are out there and they're really publishing amazing works. And I mean, even aside from the New Yorker and the Paris Review, I mean, two lovely, lovely journals that I personally subscribe to and enjoy every week or every issue when they come out. There are a whole host of other journals out there across the nation, across the world, that are doing really good things.
There's a lot of changes in publishing over the last 10, 20 years, particularly because of digital publishing. And it sounds like, since you teach multimedia, that you probably know a lot about that. Have those changes impacted the small journals, or are they pretty much still doing things the way they always have?
Yeah, that is so interesting. I mean, if you look at the New Yorker's example, I mean, the New Yorker has done such a beautiful job with their digital version of their print magazine. If you look at the iPad version of the New Yorker, it's one of the most beautifully put together digital magazines or journals I've seen. The Paris Review is also doing this. But the other interesting piece about this is that the smaller presses, the independent presses, I feel have had more opportunity to not only get started, but also to play around with the market in a larger way, because publishing online doesn't cost the same that it would if you're putting it into print or every issue into print. And so you've got a number of independent journals out there who are able to publish a consistent online journal at a very minimal cost. You know, they're paying for their sites, they're paying for potentially a handful of staff, and they probably have a number of volunteers. But generally, they can put their issues out at very minimal cost, and then maybe they're doing an annual print or a biannual or quarterly or something like that. That's not only based off of their monthly or weekly issues, but is sort of adding to that with some original additional work. It's really an interesting publishing model overall, and for those of us who really grew up with the print model and still love the print, myself being included, it certainly was a little scary, to say the least, you know, at the start of all this, but it really has opened opportunity not only for these newer journals that are really primarily online, but also for our print journals. I mean, we can get into the New Yorker and the Paris Review even, although the New Yorker probably does more with this, but we can get into the New Yorker and very quickly find these short stories on a fantastic writer, teacher, person, woman, National Book Award winner, Alice McDermott. I had the privilege of working with her a few times, and when I saw that she had a story published in the New Yorker called Someone, I was just shocked, and you know, I would have had to wait for it if I hadn't already subscribed. My husband actually brought it to me with a cup of coffee in the morning in bed. He's like, you know, he hands it to me and he says, "Honey, Alice McDermott's in the New Yorker," and I was so shocked because I never thought that she would actually write a short story. She has been such a devout novelist for so long, but because we have this online feature of the New York, we didn't have to have a subscription to find our favorite authors. And I think that that's really wonderful, and not only an informational dissemination way, but also in a marketing way. It's cheap advertising for the publishing houses and small press journals and so on. So I think that there's goodness there. I think that it can sometimes work against the print model, but I think that it's just a transition overall.
Ray, are there any sort of digital-first new journals that you really see as up-and-coming that are really, you know, are where's the next Paris Review coming from in the digital world?
Well, I'll just plug the journal that I'm editing right now, the Dr. T.J. Eckelberg Review, we just put out our first issue, and we launched it at AWP this year in Chicago. And we do consider ourselves primarily online. We have plans for an incoming annual print that's still in talk at this point. But we had a great launch, and we've had a lot of interest. And, of course, we're transitioning from its predecessor, Moon Milk Review, that I had started a few years back with some friends from Johns Hopkins I graduated with. And we're seeing a really good response to it. There's also a number of other journals that I think are doing some really amazing things. Tank Magazine being one of them. It's very highly respected amongst its peers. And Roxane Gay is one of the editors there, and she, honestly, her writing in particular is really what attracted me to Pink to begin with, because I had just fallen in love with her stories, her short stories. Mm-hmm. And specifically, there are so many journals locally. Barrel House is out of D.C., and I really like their eclectic vision that they have. They really look at so much in terms of style and concept, and allow for writers to submit pieces really from many different places, and they have an interest in what we would call pop culture, which I think is very interesting. There are just so many wonderful magazines out there that's established and new and up and coming, and I couldn't even begin to list them all off because there really are so many. One that's been very important to me over the last couple years is Frederick Bartholomew's new magazine, Flip. And it is online. It was formed online originally, and that's pretty much all that they do is online. And of course, Rick brings with him a whole host of talent that he bought from Mississippi whenever he left Mississippi and started this new venture.
And what was it called again?
It's been really kind of a guiding light in terms of not only content, but experimentation in terms of the different issues. But I would definitely suggest anyone who's interested in online journals and reading short stories, they should check out Flip magazine.
Wait, was that Flip?
Flip. It's B-L-I-T. Flip.
Blip magazine. Now, the Mission Creek Literary Festival has on Saturday, March 31st, has a small press and literary journal book fair at the Mill in Iowa City, and that's a free event. So anyone who's interested in learning more about the wide variety of literary journals and small presses out there, that would be a good place to start. And Ray Bryant, our guest today, is reading Friday, March 30th, at the Emerging Writers Reading at Prairie Lights, and I believe that starts at 6 p.m. on Friday, March 30th, and that's also a free event. And the Small Press and Literary Journal Book Fair was Saturday, March 31st, to make that clear. So it's a week from tomorrow if you're listening to us live. Now, with your literary journal that you're doing at Johns Hopkins University, which you said is primarily digital, is it web-based, or do you do ebook publications of it as well?
We are web-based, and right now that's our primary format. We are discussing a print, an annual print, and I'm sure the ebook will become part of that at some point. Right now, we're more focused on getting our staff together and formulating the longer vision of the magazine. Right now, we were very fortunate to have an original fiction in our first issue by Rick Moody, and we also had original fiction from Stephen Dixon, an excerpt of his novel he's been working on for several years now, and he's looking soon to put that out. I also I also did a very short Q&A with Zach Galifianakis from The Hangover, and that was a lot of fun. It was an email interview through one of his assistants, but he was a real good sport about it, and we did something of a spoof off of a centerfold kind of aesthetic, where we took his face and put it on classic nude painting. Botticelli and Titian, you know, all these famous artists. We had a lot of fun with it. We're trying not to take ourselves too seriously. We're trying to have fun with our art, so to speak.
And probably being digital, like you said, it's easier to do more with art because you don't have the printing costs involved with full color and
Exactly. It's liberating in so many ways. We're able to do full color through the entire issue. It's so lovely. And I have to say, I mean, the predecessor of Moonwalk Review that I started, we did actually get a printout before the transition over to Eckelberg, and the print experience was just fabulous. And the cover of it was full color, and I had found this just gorgeous, gorgeous painter, artist, Alexis Spado, who I think she's sort of a combination of Cezanne and Picasso together, and she just did these wonderful paintings, and she was good enough to let me use one of them for the cover. So we did full color on the cover, but then the internal artwork is black and white. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't striking, because I felt that it certainly was, but you know, when you can go full color like that, it's so lovely in so many ways. And I think, at least the last couple of issues I've seen in Paris Review, they still do the color internal artwork, which I think is amazing.
Oh, absolutely.
I wish that we could have done that for Moonwalk Review, but, you know, we just didn't have the budget for it, being independent and not holding any big fundraisers or anything like that. But, yes, the online, absolutely, Monica, it's very liberating.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my guest today is Ray Bryant, whose short story collection, The Indefinite State of Imaginary Morals, was released from Patasola Press, New York, in June 2011, and she's speaking at Prairie Lights on Friday, March 30th in Iowa City, which is how she came to our attention. I'm wondering, is it possible, you know, you mentioned that you were surprised that Alice McDermott wrote a short story, and it doesn't seem that it's really very viable to make a living as a short story writer.
No, you're absolutely right. It's really not. I mean, you really don't want your child to wake up in the morning and say, "Mom, I just want to be a short story writer. That's what my dream is, and, you know, that's all I'm going to do." That's a little scary, because it's really not something you can make money at. Though it should be said that there's so much honor in it from, I think, a literary standpoint. I mean, the short story is such a gem in so many ways. The longer short story and what we would consider a flash fiction or short story or whatever, you know, someone wants to call that. It has a beauty in and of itself. Not only, I think, from an artistic standpoint, but also from a craft standpoint, in building your voice and really getting a sensibility of what the story means to you. You have this much quicker arc drawing, and you're able to form that story, at least the structure of it and some sensibility of it, more quickly, so that if the short story becomes something that you engage with, it not only can become an art form you really enjoy, but it can also feed into longer works, such as a novel, because isn't it nice when we get to the end of the chapter and we not only have a sense of wanting to explore further into the meaning of this narrative, but we also feel a sense of some kind of closure, or maybe not closure, but some kind of cyclical impact, so that we feel that there is form and structure to that particular chapter. And I think that the short story and the novel, when you write both of them together, I really feel that they can help inform the other in terms of craft. Christmas story, and you had asked about Alice. If you would like me to speak on that, yes, my very first workshop at Johns Hopkins was with Alice, and I'll never forget it. I came to her with short stories. In fact, I believe most everyone in the workshop did, and she said something to me at one point. And keep in mind, what I was writing was very raw. It was very new in terms of me just being, you know, a very young writer person. And she never flinched. She just took what I gave her, and she really was not looking to change my voice or to do anything other than to help me find my best voice. And she said to me, "Ray," she said, "a female story, a woman's story is enough." And it stuck with me all these years, because that's kind of really what my focus has been over the years, is not only the woman's story, but how the genders engage in not only physical senses, but also in mental and mindful sensibilities as well. And, you know, to have someone of Alice's caliber say that just meant so much. But all through that workshop, she had not shared with us anything in terms of her own short story writing. She was just devoutly a novelist and spoke really to that, but was able to so well guide us with the short story format. So I had a feeling maybe she was writing short stories and she just wasn't telling us. But even at Suwannee last summer, when I conferenced with her for my work, she had not mentioned the short story or anything like that. So, yes, I was so delighted and surprised and just ecstatic to see the story in New Yorker.
Now, Ray, let's talk more about your work.
Okay.
When we were communicating by email, you referred to your stories as very blunt. And and I'm going to read some of the praise from your book, which is, well, I'll just read it. Reading Ray Bryant can be a harrowing experience. Hers is a harsh world without wrong or right. But as you make your way through, pains and pleasures meet and build until it's like drowning in a lake of silver light. That was from Ben Lurie, the author of Stories for Nighttime and Some for the Day. Ray Bryant's fiction is smart and sexy and post-feminist and dangerous and akin to doing the tango with a succubus. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, but I know.
Succubus,
I know what that means. That's from, it's with enough intense characters, flashy dreams, and edgy visions to entangle your heart and skull for eons. Bite into these thorny stories before they sink their teeth into you. That's from Richard Peabody, editor of the Gargoyle magazine. So, edgy. Your work is I would describe as edgy. Now, you don't sound like an edgy person in in conversation. What draws you to writing like that?
You know, I think it's the symptom of my education, essentially, and also I don't know. Let me just say, as a young person, I was drawn to Edgar Allan Poe very early on. My mother, that was a collection of short stories that she really loved, and so she gave me one when I was young. And I watched late night double chore theater with Fritz the Night Owl. It was kind of an Ohio specific series that ran late at night. And I think it was Saturday night. So I've always been drawn to the dark and the awkward and the uncomfortable pieces of humanity, and I don't know if I can blame it on Edgar Allan Poe, but I can certainly trace it back, I think, to that. You know, and I recently was doing some research for the novel I'm writing right now, and I found this fantastic article. I mean, it's very sad, but it was just so poignant. It was about that, and I wish I could remember the writer of the article offhand, but I'm sorry I can't. It was about the Guatemalan population and government, and there's a high Mayan population in Guatemala, and it spoke about the Mayan decline and how the government was trying to use the overpopulation issue of the Mayan decline as a reason for modern Maya women to engage in abortion and sterilization in order to keep letting this happen again. And they even went forward to use something of a feminist indoctrination in terms of, you know, own your body, you know, don't fall prey to this this procreation agenda, so to speak. So I just, you know, it just really struck me as it's really interesting in terms of, you know, what has happened to civilizations prior, how that engages with women, and how we're sort of repeating some of these same mistakes to the point of an assimilation issue for these Mayan people, and specifically how that impacts the female population within it. And I've always kind of been very, well, obviously being female, I've been very interested in that. I would never call myself a feminist, but I am certainly interested in the darkness and the structural, what should I say here? How some social structures can put upon the female population these sort of difficult situations, and they've always drawn me from literature to art to anthropology to everything, and so I guess that just comes out in my writing.
Well, I think a lot of people are drawn to to the darker side of literature, particular movies. Of course, horror movies are always popular, and sometimes in the past, I years ago wrote some short stories that were maybe a little dark. I wouldn't say they were nearly as edgy as some of yours, but and I would show them to people who were like, I don't. They saw it, the story is so different from the way they saw me. They had a hard time putting the two together. In fact, they thought it was a little scary. Yeah. Do you get that reaction sometimes? Are people a little
scared? It is. It's interesting. I mean, especially, you know, being a mom, you know, being a teacher. Of course, I'm teaching at the collegiate level now, so it's not the same. But it is interesting. And I, you know, it is something that I think some women writers struggle with. I think that's part of why Alice has said to me what she said about a woman's story being enough, that you can write this, you can be a mom, you can be a woman in society and still write what directly impacts you. And, you know, it comes out, I think I was interviewed by Gary Frisabi not too long ago for the Nervous Breakdown, and the issue of a woman's war came up. And I keep going back to the issue that a woman's war, you know, may not be on a battlefield like Hemingway, or, you know, Byron's war or so on. But honestly, our war, it surrounds us. We walk into a deserted parking garage, and we're aware of if there's anyone behind us, if we hear any footsteps, we've got our finger on the unlock button to get into our car quickly. We have wars in our bedrooms. We have wars in our kitchens. You know, there are definitely wars that we come into contact with, and then I take that into sort of the Derrida philosophy, you know, and take that into some kind of moral nihilism, you know, where you look at the social structures and the gender structures that have been set up for us in terms of what's expected of women, and how we are supposed to write nice things, how we're supposed to do nice things, and we're not supposed to engage with these darker pieces that historically has been said to be the male landscape, so to speak. Well, you know, honestly, I don't know. I think day to day we see that what Derrida called the violent hierarchy. I see that day to day in workplaces between genders. I see it day to day, you know, in some form or another between husband and wives, between wives and wives and husbands and husbands, regardless of that relationship structure, I think that it's really there. And so, I don't know, for a woman, as a mother, I want my daughter to think about these things earlier. I want her to think about them before she goes off to college. I want her to think about the different pieces of life that are out there waiting for her when she's out from under my roof and I'm not, just a mile away from the school from her. And yet I personally have survived a college rape. And so I know what the real war in that is, and I also have feelings about this idea about moral nihilism, that really some of these constructs set up for women are based upon where we've come, which to some degree has been a man's idea of what women are and supposed to be. And so I guess through my stories, I do try to push those boundaries. I try not to answer them, but I try to allow the reader an opportunity to think about what this might mean to them. And I just hope that in some way I'm able to present that landscape for readers to be able to do that.
Well, let's give our listeners a chance to hear an example.
Okay. Well, I guess the first piece I'll read is from the collection The Indefinite State of Imaginary Morals, published by Pedestal Press. And this story is very short. It's titled Intolerable Imposition. She gnawed her arm off in the morning before he woke. There was no way around it. The forearm lay trapped beneath his thick neck, stubbled except for one irritated spot of skin below the hairline where an infected pore rounded, tipped with pus. She had seen it in the night before, the infection. She saw it in the dim bar light, pulsating, but the blemish did not matter after two glasses of Cabernet. And besides, he presented so well from the front, pressed, suited, hip but not too metro tie, square jaw, and straight white teeth. His hair was thinning, inconsequential. After a tolerable sexing, top, bottom, behind, sideways, over the edge of the bed, he turned his back and asked if she would find the ingrown hair on his neck because it hurt him, and he had no one to do it now that his mother had passed away 3 months ago. In the dark silence of their after sex, he explained how his mother cleaned the area with hydrogen peroxide and extracted the infection, fishing inside with tweezers and a needle to find the ascending hair. He spoke with soft words. She could always find it so quickly. Now I have no one. Would you mind? The tweezers and the peroxide are in the bathroom cabinet. It was a test, though he did not admit it. She had known other men like him, men who searched for a dedicated intimate, a partner, and squeamish. It was their way of telling the keepers from the one-nighters. She begged off the immediate task. I'll do it in the morning, she said, smiling, as if the task did not disgust her. She woke before him. The bulbous infection lay millimeters from her nose, an inch from her forearm. It would touch her if he rolled backward toward her. As long as he lay motionless, she was safe. Pulling her arm in small increments, she worked it from beneath his neck, but each time her forearm moved, he moved so that he inched himself backward, forming into her an intolerable spooning. She had not consented to affection. There was no contract between them for this cuddling, nor was there in provision for lovemaking, only sex implied, and she cringed at the familiarity of his back and buttocks and legs where they contacted her skin. It may have been different if he faced her. He was much prettier from the sun. So she rolled to her back, letting only her side and arm touch him now. She considered pulling the arm outright, facing his wakening before leaving a fake phone number. She considered pushing on his right shoulder so to roll him onto his belly, which may have released the arm, but still it was risky and would likely wake him that way too. After endless scenarios imagined, pulling and pushing and facing the man she now loathed for no other reason than the cyst upon his neck, she considered loving him. She could simply stay and wait by his side, their eggs and coffee and the Washington Post, before returning to bed. But the venture brought the inevitable task of extracting the hair and the pus, and she found herself glaring at the thick, heavy neck with hatred. Only one thing to do. It took her the better part of an hour to gnaw through the bone. The flesh was easy, soft, pliable, seasoned with skin creams and the experience of her near 30 years. The blood, however, threatened to give her away. It pooled on the mattress beneath them, and he nearly woke from the wet. As she snuck out of the bedroom, she turned to watch the sleeping man who now clutched her forearm. He pulled it to his chest and hugged it like a child's teddy bear. She remembered mornings when she, too, clutched forearms to her chest. It wasn't so bad. At least they had left her something before leaving. She tied off the left sleeve of her coat, moved out of the apartment and into a hallway, missing the forearm already, but resolved to leaving it. Waking him and his fist would certainly turn into the day, the week, a year, and before long she might consider him more than a fancy. He would fill her life with a series of cystic burdens. He would seize her entirely. A single forearm was well worth the escape.
Thank you. Oh. That was Ray Bryant reading from her short story collection, The Indefinite State of Imaginary Morals. So, wow. That's kind of shocking.
Yes, I've gotten a reaction before.
But the images are so vivid. I mean, particularly that cyst, that thing on his neck.
Yes, I know. I do have something of a strange way with grotesque images, I know, and I guess that maybe I should apologize for that a little bit, but yeah.
Wow. Well, we only have a few minutes before Joe is ready to go on the air, and I wanted to ask you, as a former teacher of literature, did you have your students dissect stories and, you know, say, what was the meaning of this? And was this a metaphor for something else? And if so, how do you feel about people doing that to your stories? And is there always a metaphor or a meaning behind everything?
You know, I am a strong believer in deconstructionism. I really did come from the school of Derrida. I believe deconstructing a work is important, not really for the work itself, but for the reader, to better understand what that work means to the reader. And so that analysis piece is really important. I think that that is a necessary part of reading. I mean, when I read another story, it's what I do naturally. I may not do it on the first read-through fully, but when I read through again, especially a short story or a poem, a novel, of course, I can't help but to break it apart and take a look at the different pieces, not only in terms of what it means within the work itself, but also what it means to the landscape of that time period, potentially, if I'm looking at it historically, or to my own life, because then it forms meaning for me individually as the reader. For others to do that, I find it fascinating. I really hesitate ever to try and talk about my work in terms of what it means specifically, because I hope that readers can form their own connection with the work on what it means to them. There were a few reviews actually that spoke about the work in terms of parts, that there, throughout the stories in the collection, there's this recurring imagery of body parts, Mind the part. You know, it, it's true. I mean, maybe this isn't such a good thing, but it's sort of this concept of not only talking about in a romantic sense, in a detachment sense, and instead of kind of looking at these parts of people individually and together with some type of objectivity. And that was very interesting to me, and it actually helped inform on me in terms mm-hmm. of really what these stories were doing together. I think that sometimes our readers bring things to the table that are necessary.
That's a very good point.
Not only them, but I'm sorry, yeah.
That's a very good point, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but I actually I've got Joe waiting on the other line, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Ray.
Thank you so much,
and
Monica. It was a pleasure.
It'll be great seeing you in Iowa City on the 30th.
Yes, I look forward to it.
All right. And now, just stay with me a moment, and we'll get Joe on the line.
Sure thing.
Hi, Joe.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, we are on the air.
Yeah, I was listening in. That's great.
This is now you're going to have to pronounce your last name for me, so I don't mess it up.
Yeah, it's Tiefenthaler.
Tiefenthaler. Wow, that must have some meaning.
Oh, you know, I've been told a couple of different meanings by people who speak German, and I can never keep the right one straight. I think it has something to do with the valley.
All right. Well, Joe. Your role with the Mission Creek Literary Series is?
I coordinate the literary programming.
And how long have you been doing this?
This is year three.
Year three. Right now, here. The Mission Creek Festival itself has been going on for, was it 7 years or something like that?
7 years, yeah.
Yeah, and has the literary part always been part of it?
There's always been readings, but we really, when I came on board, I was asked to do so in order to make it a leg of the festival. So that's also been 3 years running.
Wow. Yeah, I think it's really one of the things that I think is so cool about this festival is that, you know, you've got the music, you've got the food, you've got the literary aspect of it, and I don't know, it makes it more complete than just a literary festival or just a music festival.
Well, it's all things that, you know, people in Iowa City and in southeast Iowa or just across the border in Illinois, it's a lot of things that people just care about, and it's in the culture to begin with. And so it's just about celebrating these elements that everyone just really wants to take part in.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about what you've got coming up.
Well, this year, it's a little bit of a program for us. The festival this year is only 6 days. Last year, it was like an 8-day monstrosity. But this year, across 6 days, we have 16 readings and a book fair across 13 different venues around Iowa City. And we have writers coming to participate, like Alan Heathcock. You just heard from Ray Bryant. She'll be reading Johannes Gorenson, D.A. Powell, Kevin Brockmeyer. A lot of people traveling in, a lot of people from Iowa City, just trying to put them in a room together.
Wow. We talked a little bit during the interview with Ray about the small press literary journal aspect. Is that kind of an important or kind of a central theme of this festival?
It's very important for us to have this book fair because you're able to represent a lot of the publishers that are putting out some of the books that, you know, we like the most or just some of the highest quality journals and presses out there. We did have this the last couple of years, and it's been growing. This year we're very proud to have folks come in. Ray spoke of Hank Magazine early on in her interview. We're happy to have them back in Iowa City alongside, like, Grantham Magazine, Tin House, A Public Space, N+1, Featherproof Press, Saraband, the list goes on and on. I think in all this year we'll have over 40 tables, which is a fairly sizable increase from last year.
Wow.
And that's all, and it's all free to get into. It's free for the presses and journals to have a table. So we really just want people to spend their money at the tables buying these wonderful books.
And that's on Saturday, March 31st at the Mill.
Yep.
From 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then at 3 p.m., we have the Grantham Magazine Presents. What exactly is that?
Well, yeah, and that's what we're very glad to have Grantham Magazine back. The editor, John Freeman, and the assistant editor, Patrick Ryan, will be coming into town. And they, like they did last year, they hosted a reading, which sort of is and celebrates the end of the book fair. We will have authors like the local writer, Chinella Ocfronta. Amelia Gray is going to read, whose really wonderful book just came out earlier this month called Threats. Matt Hart will be reading, a poet out of Ohio who runs a literary press and journal called Forklift Ohio. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a Granta representative in Kevin Brockmeyer, sort of encapsulating this whole combination of what it means to put a literary journal like Granta in with a really what is a rock and roll festival.
Do you have any recommendations on the music side?
I'm very much so looking forward to seeing, you know, some of the big hitters like Shayan Kuti in Egypt 80. Will Whitmore as a local is always fun to see play in Iowa City. But some people that may surprise as a live band will be bands like Oberhofer. Sharon Van Etten will put on a really wonderful show. The War on Drugs is a buzzier band. They're going to be playing this festival too. I'm really looking forward to seeing stuff that is going to take place in alternative venues. We have this sort of noise avant-garde musician-composer in Tim Hecker coming, and he'll be doing an event in a church because he needs a pipe organ to do what he wants.
Now, if you're listening on Friday to our live broadcast, stay tuned at 2 p.m. James Moore with Planet Erstwhile will be interviewing Andre Perry, who is the co-founder and of the Mission Creek Festival and the director of Englert Theater and The Mill. So you can hear a lot more about the rock and roll aspect of the festival. Now, one of the things that really appealed to me, because I love to eat, is you've got a literary food crawl kind of thing going on.
Yeah, we're taking last year's model of our lit crawl, which will be 8 events in 3 hours, and it proceeds, you know, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. Folks will walk from the south end of Iowa City up to the north side, and they'll have decisions to make because at each level there will be 3 or 2 readings going on at the same time. You know, and they're being hosted by these presses and journals that you will see at the book fair. And it's a mix of writers from out of town and writers from in town, writers from all over the Midwest and writers from the coasts. So we took this model, and what we added, a food component, which basically and loosely will follow the appetizer, main course, dessert structure of a meal, because we figured out last year with these things happening during what would be the dinner hour that we should probably feed some people, and we're very excited to take what we started as a structure for what will be the Sunday brunch and just highlight some more of the really great kitchens that are from all over town. They will be supplying, donating food. So as you're going around and you're getting some literature, you're seeing some new writers that you've never been introduced to before, some presses and journals that you've never read before, you'll also sort of just get a little tasty treat at each stop.
Mm. And that's all free?
It's all free.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, the guest we had on last week is your kind of kicking off the festival on Tuesday night, Luis Alberto Oria. And wow, he was just so entertaining as a guest. I imagine he'll be just as entertaining or even more so in person.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to having him kick off the festival, really. He will be the first event that takes place during Mission Creek. Even, you know, he, as a writer, highlights one of our latest pushes. We're really getting these artists, musicians, and authors into various classrooms or public spaces to interact with the public on a more one-to-one and intimate level. And we have Lewis will be doing that afternoon, a Spanish language Q&A discussion session with the Spanish language creative writing program here, which just started.
Oh, wow.
We have other folks that will be doing fiction workshops during the day. The Michael Martone and Robin Hemley, Pinky Benedict, four short stories of the apocalypse. We'll be spending that day at the Iowa City Public Library doing concentrated fiction workshops for undergraduate and graduate students, And then we have the spoken word artists that will be performing Saturday, both the actress Amber Tamblyn and Derek Brown. They're going to be working with youth from all over the state, teaching them how to recite their own poetry, and they'll be doing that for free at the Engler on Sunday at 5 o'clock. We're really just trying to make sure that these artists get involved with the community in as many ways as possible, not just perform.
So on the workshops at the public library, are those only open to students at the University of Iowa, or are they open to other people?
I do think they are open only to students at the university, but if you check out the Iowa City Public Library website, I do think there is more information.
Okay.
It's there. They may end up opening it up as well.
Okay. Yeah. Is this the first time that you've done this as part of the festival?
It's the first time it's been this prominent. We've always had our guests lecturing or getting into classrooms, but we're making a more concerted effort this year and planning on even more for next year.
Wow, great. Great. How do you go about deciding whom to invite?
Usually the group, we get together for the first time in the fall. We'll do it again this coming fall. We'll talk just about wish lists. It's really, it's a group of people that really like to read and really like music and performance art, and sort of we just have a few pitch meetings where our favorite writers will get thrown out there, our favorite musicians, we talk about possibilities, and we just start sending out emails and pestering people into coming and taking part into this. But it is really just a crazy wish list of a festival.
And where does the funding for the festival come from?
The funding, we have a lot of really great partners. MC Ginsberg is really sort of integral into what we're doing for the literary programming. But a lot of locals, a lot of Midwest, just sponsorship levels. We get some donations from local businesses downtown. But otherwise, it's ticket sales. The festival does drive itself, but we do rely on a lot of really great partners and local donors.
So most of the musical events are not free. There's a charge.
Yeah, there will be free music events that usually occur earlier in the evening. There will be stuff going on actually above the Deadwood. We have a concert Friday night for free at Joe's Place. Okay. And then on Saturday afternoon during the Lit Crawl, there are also free in-store shows across downtown Iowa City, and that schedule is available on our website at missionfreak.com. So there are some free events and music. Only one of the literary events costs money, so everything that you want to do literary-wise is free.
Right, and that one is the... you want to talk a little bit about that in the last minute we have here? Amber?
That is the Amber Tamblyn, Bo Sia, and Derek Brown performance Saturday night at the Mill. These guys are some of the biggest artists in the genre. Bo Sia was a mainstay back when HBO had the show Deaf Poetry. He was, I think, a contributing producer, and he was a frequent performer. Derek Brown runs Right Bloody Publishing, which is this really wonderful spoken word and poetry press out of the West Coast. And Amber is just such a supporter. She does a lot with, she has her own nonprofit poetry organization. They do a lot of these performances across the U.S. They do a lot of it in L.A. and a lot of it in New York, and they've never done this in Iowa City, and we're very excited to have them.
Great. Well, thanks for being with us today, Joe. I look forward to seeing you next week in Iowa City.
And I look forward to meeting you guys.
Great. And stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore interviewing Andre Perry, more about the Mission Creek Festival, followed by Beth Howard, whose new book, Making Peace, a Memoir of Love, Loss, and Pie, is a rich slice of life. And see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom.